The Record Podcast is supported by Sound Solutions, providing counseling and therapeutic services to help with life's challenges such as depression, anxiety, addiction, and more, with personalized care that helps patients restore balance to their lives. With 7 locations serving King County, more at soundsolutions.health. Sound Solutions. Care today.
Welcome to The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. President Trump said, America first. A former UN ambassador says peace works. That's the name of Rick Barton's new book about, quote, America's unifying role in a turbulent world. You'll meet Rick Barton coming up in just a few minutes. I hope you can stay with us. First of all, today, the man accused in the Pittsburgh synagogue massacre appeared briefly in a federal courthouse today to face charges that he killed 11 people in the attack. The congregants were attending a baby naming ceremony at the time. In Seattle, Mayor Durkan says she's stepping up security for places of worship. Tonight, a vigil and prayer service will unite different faith communities at Capitol Hill's Temple to Hersh Sinai. Daniel Wiener is the rabbi there. Rabbi, thank you for coming in again.
Of course.
Also on the line with us is Rivi Pupko-Klitenik, who's the head of the Seattle Hebrew Academy, who grew up in that neighborhood, Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh. Rivi, thanks for coming on.
Sure.
You grew up in the area where these shootings took place. What was that neighborhood like for you?
It was a magical neighborhood growing up. And thank you for asking so we could share the magic of Squirrel Hill. It was a neighborhood where people sat on their porches and everyone was friends with everyone, Jewish, non-Jewish, all different flavors of people sharing a neighborhood, shopping in stores together, playing in the playground together, going to school together. It was a really beautiful place to grow up. My father built a synagogue on Murray Avenue, one of the center streets down our neighborhood, and he was always treated with so much respect by everyone. We would walk down the street, and everyone knew everyone.
How much do you hear or suspect that the neighborhood has changed?
I would hope that it would not change. I feel that people make a neighborhood, and the people that live in Pittsburgh are really amazing people. They're strong, they're resilient, they're friendly, they're open. My mom would drive anywhere in the town and pick up people off the street and say, where can I give you a lift to? And that's the way we grew up, with a very openness in our home and openness in our synagogue and openness in the community. And I think Tree of Life Synagogue was that way, welcoming refugees, caring about the stranger. And I hope that will never change. We can't allow that to change.
Rivi, I know that you know Rabbi Daniel Wiener from Temple to Hersh Sinai.
Yes.
Rabbi, what would you say about your Capitol Hill neighborhood?
Well, first of all, and Rivi, I'll see you later, but I just wanted to extend my deepest sympathies for this abomination in such a wonderful place in which you grew up. Our Capitol Hill neighborhood, I think, is diverse and eclectic. But really just in the last 48 hours, we have received so many different gestures, such an outpouring of support and love, people bringing flowers and cards, particularly from some of our interfaith neighbors at St. James Cathedral, St. Mark's Cathedral, the First AME Church. People have really gone out of their way within the neighborhood to reaffirm to us that they stand with us and that they love us and care about us and are reaching out at a time of dire need.
I would add that we were so moved that the head of St. Joe's, a school on our block, brought us flowers this morning, and that made our kids feel really safe and loved.
Rivi, what are you saying to children at your academy today?
So this morning we spoke to the kids, and one of the things I spoke to them about was that this week's biblical portion that we read in synagogue and that morning was read at Tree of Life was that Abraham and Sarah had an open tent, which means they welcomed everyone into their tent, and God was about to appear to Abraham, and I jokingly said to the kids, and Abraham put God on hold. and went to take care of the stranger and opened up the tent and fed and took care of the needy. And you know, sometimes kids aren't the ones that are necessarily at this moment going to be able to go out and help the strangers. They're going to make sandwiches and they're going to give them to homeless people. But I also want them to not say to their friends, don't sit here, I'm saving it for my friend. We're all friends. I don't want to play with this child. No, we want to play with all the children. And what does it mean to be a good friend to everyone?
What are your thoughts, Rabbi?
That's a wonderful interpretation of the Torah portion. I also kind of focused on that on Sunday in the aftermath of the shooting with children and families at our religion school. And I would add just one more interpretation in good rabbinic style here, that there's other interpretations that say that when God visited Abraham, Abraham interpreted God's presence as the coming of those strangers. And so in many ways, when we welcome strangers, we are, in essence, welcoming God's presence into our lives. And that's something that is invaluable in Judaism. It's something that always has been an invaluable principle of our nation, but it's something that is clearly under threat right now.
Yes, I want to ask both of you here, we're talking about welcoming strangers in open tents. What happens to security at the synagogue, at the school, the Seattle Hebrew Academy? Are you thinking about that?
We think about it all the time, and we do what we need to do, and we still continue to seek and desire and want a degree of openness for our community. My parents were both immigrants that were welcomed to this country, and we have to value that about our country and our community.
What about you, Rabbi?
No, I would agree with that and just add that, unfortunately, we're living in a time when we need to be more security conscious, not just the Jewish community, it's been something that we've been sensitive to for at least the last 20 years in terms of having security more present and visible, but also many houses of worship, churches, mosques, Sikh temples have been attacked over the last few years. And so I think all of us are seeking to balance a sense of religious communities being open and welcoming, but also responding to the reality of a world in which for certain specific individuals, we need to be cautious, we need to be wary.
Rabbi, what have you noticed the effect is, if you can say, on, we talked about this before our microphones opened up. I was just, I take my kids to the Jewish Community Center near me, and of course we see you have to buzz through and all that. And what is the sense of barrier and security doors and alarms, what effect does that have on your congregants, do you think?
You know, I think people feel somewhat conflicted to the extent that we wish we lived in a world in which we didn't need those things. We didn't need our synagogues and houses of worship to need guards overtly up front as deterrents. But I think also people appreciate the fact that that we're taking responsible action. And certainly when these kinds of extreme situations occur, there is a greater sense of fear and anxiety. But I think over time, people have, for better or for worse, become accustomed to, inured to, needing to have a security presence and the kind of facilities that protect our congregants. They need to know that when they come there with their families, that they're going to be safe to live life and to practice their faith and to identify as Jews.
Rivi, do your kids talk to you about that at Seattle Hebrew Academy?
They absolutely do. And, you know, they noticed this morning a lot of Seattle police presence. And I want to appreciate the Seattle police for that. They were proactive and in touch with us, offering what can they do. And so when they came into school, it felt a little different, but they saw the Seattle police there, and that gave them a feeling of security.
Rabbi, this is just a little bit of the comment over the weekend from the rabbi at the Tree of Life Synagogue, Jeffrey Myers. There are some long applause breaks, which I took out just to sort of tighten things up, but I'd like for both of you to give a listen and any reaction.
It starts with speech. Words of hate are unwelcome in Pittsburgh. It starts with everyone in this room. And I want to address for a moment some of our political leaders who are here. Ladies and gentlemen, it has to start with you as our leaders. My words are not intended as political fodder. I address all equally. Stop the words of hate. My mother always taught me, if you don't have anything nice to say, say nothing.
Rabbi Wiener, you noted the laughter in the room when he said that this is not meant as political fodder. Have you been addressing politics and political speech to your congregants?
Certainly not in these first days. I think we have to focus on what's kind of most important and imminent, and that is reaching out to the Pittsburgh community and reaching out to those within our community who are feeling such a sense of pain and loss and a degree of fear and anxiety. I think in the coming days and weeks, though, the conversation is going to need to focus on the discourse that exacerbates the divisiveness and polarization that we are obviously experiencing in this country. And that discourse, that toxic rhetoric, emanates from the highest reaches of our government currently.
Well, how do you want to address that?
Again, it's for down the road.
Not for today?
Not for today, but I think down the road, many of us are going to be coming together to speak to that. And I think people who might have been complacent previously are newly activated and newly sensitized to the devastating impact that such a climate might foster.
Any thoughts, Rivi Popko-Klatenik from Seattle Hebrew Academy?
Well, I deeply agree with the rabbi of Tree of Life. Our thoughts become our words become our actions, and we must guard the words that come out from our lips. And I love that he quoted his mother. I hope my children will do the same. They are words to live by, and we need to start with ourselves, our families, our children, and continuously set the standard for appropriate speech. And I think as a society, we need to make it clear to our public figures that we expect this of them.
Rivi, how would you quote your mother or your father, who was a rabbi there in Pittsburgh for decades?
Well, I will tell you, my father lived for 2.5 years in Radin, Poland, with one of our greatest sages, the Chafetz Chaim, who wrote a book on proper speech. After I studied that book, I asked my father, I was like, Daddy, did this man ever talk? It looks like you can barely say anything. And my father said he always spoke. He spoke continuously, but always about morals and ethics and belief. So we have been endowed with speech, and we can use our speech for good.
And that was your father. You were appreciative of the rabbi in Pittsburgh quoting his mother. Did your mother pass down any quotes that you would pass on to the little ones?
Oh, there are quite a few of those quotes that my mother would say. I think the most important one was stand up straight and do your best.
Mm-hmm. I mentioned that there's going to be a vigil this evening, and I think you're both going to be there.
Yes.
Is that right? What do you want to get out of that, Rivi?
I want to be able to be together with people and be together with our community and give, you know, a voice to what Squirrel Hill was and is and will continue to be, and really begin to also be hopeful and full of dreams for how our words and how we can be human agents in creating a better future for our community.
And you'll be speaking there tonight, Rabbi, is that right?
Yeah, Rivi will as well.
Yes.
I hope to get the same kind of thing to both. In planning this, we are focusing certainly on the more solemn aspects of commemorating the loss, but really, what's the next step? How are we going to respond to that? How are we going to, in true Jewish fashion, embrace life, embrace hope, embrace the future, and hopefully craft a world in which these kinds of things don't happen with this degree of frequency?
Well, respectfully, I want to bring up one more issue of current events, and you two can address it or not, but I'm just seeing on my computer that President Trump and the First Lady are going to visit, it's Pennsylvania, to commemorate the victims of this shooting. And I had seen that there's a progressive Jewish group that has circulated an open letter to President Trump saying, basically, you're not welcome here unless... you're not welcome in Pittsburgh until you fully denounce white nationalism, until you stop targeting endangering minorities, until you cease your assault on immigrants and refugees, until you commit yourself to compassionate democratic policies. Do you want to say nothing about politics today, Rabbi? Is that a topic not for today?
I think it's an important topic. That's for another day.
Yeah. I want to thank both of you for coming. Any final thoughts, Rivi?
My thoughts, I want to echo what Rabbi Wiener just said, and that is we really have to also pause and remember these 11 people. And their lives should not be for naught. Their deaths should be a reminder to us that we must stand up and do good. I am heartbroken for their families to come to an end of life so violently. It is trauma for the community in Pittsburgh. It's trauma for each one of their families. And it's just so breaking of one's heart. It's just not fair.
Is there anything finally you want to ask KUOW listeners who won't be at the vigil tonight, but we want to do something? What would you ask?
I would ask everyone to reach out to their neighbors and their community members, to people that perhaps they've never spoken to before, and extend a hand and say, we are both here and sharing in this human experience, and we're here to help each other.
That's Rivi Pupko-Klatenik, head of the Seattle Hebrew Academy. Any final thoughts? What a listener can do today, Rabbi?
I just think on so many levels, all of us need to come together to reclaim the values and ideals that have always defined this country and that will continue to do so if we're willing to fight for them.
Rabbi Daniel Wiener, Seattle Temple to Hirsch Sinai. And they'll both be speaking at a vigil with other faith leaders and members of the public. This is at Temple to Hirsch Sinai. In Capitol Hill, 7 o'clock tonight. Thank you. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in a moment. This is The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. On the campaign trail, President Trump announced his vision for American foreign policy. He called it America First.
After the Cold War, our foreign policy veered badly, of course. Logic was replaced with foolishness and arrogance, which led to one foreign policy disaster after another. It all began with the dangerous idea that we could make Western democracies out of countries that had no experience or interest in becoming a Western democracy. Our foreign policy is a complete and total disaster.
In his first year, the president withdrew from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, left the Paris Climate Agreement, rolled back ties with Cuba. He also called for airstrikes on Syria in retaliation for Assad's use of chemical weapons on civilians. He met with the North Korean president to talk denuclearization, but his foreign policy message remains the same: less foreign intervention. Former UN Ambassador Rick Barton disagrees with Trump, says the U.S. has an advantage in the world and we should be doing more to build peace. Ambassador Barton teaches at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton University. Thanks for coming, Ambassador.
Hey, my pleasure.
Let's begin with Trump then. What is the actual Trump doctrine, as far as you can tell, when it comes to intervention?
Well, I think it's like so much of his presidency is highly personalized, and so it's hard to tell, and very reactive to events or whatever is going on. My argument is that the United States has an advantage position. We shouldn't be arrogant about it. We should, in fact, be very humble about it. We should recognize that it is a blessing, and that if it's overplayed and if it's over-militarized, if it's hyperactive, that we can get ourselves into 17-year wars in places like Afghanistan. So it suggests that there's a wiser way to do it. But at the end of the day, wars and instability have a way of finding the United States and finding their way to our shores and finding in a variety of ways. And it also they also shrink the world that we live in. And it's the expanding world, and it's the opportunities that have come to the United States as a result of its leadership that are gigantic assets. So don't be arrogant. I mean, he's right on a couple of these points. We have been arrogant. We have gone in there in ways that have not been effective. We've encouraged war in some places. And I make the argument that I've now had enough experience to see that you can do it a much better way. And if the American people are engaged and care and have to actually, and they know that it might require some of our tax dollars and other sacrifices, and we had the Congress vote on it, there are a lot of things we could be doing that would make it a much more engaged approach, and then it wouldn't be quite so willy-nilly as it might be right now.
Well, then let's talk about the engagement of the American people. There seemed to be a big chunk of people receptive to the message that, oh, we don't have to have foreign entanglements and quagmires.
Yeah.
And as you write, American public opinion matters. Yeah. So what do you do about that?
Well, I mean, the first thing is you tell the American public that their opinion will actually be heard. Because in the case of these several of these conflicts, the opposition really hasn't been heard. There have not been good debates in Congress. There have not been official votes. So what's the point of my caring a lot if I don't have any way to express it and it doesn't have any influence on what's going on? So that part of the argument, I think, actually unites the left and the right quite well, but it speaks to a Congress that has been not particularly active. And of the last 20 conflicts, that's been the story. And then we get some sweeping, you know, war on terrorism or whatever legislation that kind of gives a blanket to presidents to do whatever they might choose to do. So that's attacked from multiple places, and I think rightly so. I happen to be one of the few people that really liked President Obama saying that he was going to go to the U.S. Congress, even though there was time to
for declarations of war.
Yeah, and there was time to do something about Syria's gassing its own people, but the Congress should vote on that. Whew, that was the end of that. Now he didn't have enough time to fight the Congress for another 3 months on that, and on top of other issues.
But could he really have won over the Congress when it comes to interfere after the Iraq and Afghanistan? I mean, what was the public appetite for getting involved any more in Syria than we are?
I think it would have to,
including and Congress representing that.
I think it would have to have been very well thought through and much more tailored. And right now, we have a couple thousand Americans in Syria. We've flattened entire cities. That's become sort of the new Chechenification of American interventions. That is not part of what I argue for in Peace Works.
Well, what's your answer for Syria?
Well, I mean, I think in the case of Syria, that the earlier interventions, the earlier opportunities were first on the humanitarian side, that we should have argued for an assertive humanitarianism, which would have insisted that the long-held and even recently voted humanitarian initiatives by the United Nations should be able to be carried out and not suppressed by the Assad regime.
So, yeah, but they're a sovereign government, so you can't force that on them.
No, but the sovereign government argument, we know, is obviously one of the places that cowards hide out. And we saw in the Kosovo War that there were airdrops. In the Bosnian War, there was an airlift into Sarajevo that was not supported really by the Serbs. And in Berlin, obviously, the Russians weren't particularly enthusiastic about the airlift that we did there. So if something like that had been initiated in Aleppo, it would have been a clear sign that, okay, your sovereignty has a limit, and among the limits would be gassing your people and violating every international humanitarian standard. So that's an assertive way that you use a non-political avenue, which happens to be humanitarian assistance, in a very political way to make a point. I also think that Assad, that the targeted responses to Assad's gas attacks, if you do that again, I can guarantee you that you will lose this palace or you will lose those planes. And I think this was, for me, what was different about the Syrian war than maybe the Libyan and the Iraq wars is that I think that Assad is ruthless, but but actually kind of sane and rational. Whereas Saddam Hussein and Gaddafi probably were like, you know, teenage boys who just had a couple too many decades running their countries. Mm.
Former UN Ambassador Rick Barton is author of the new book, Peace Works. Well, let's talk about the people from Central America, mostly Honduras, traveling toward the U.S. border. What's your take on who they are and why they're on the move?
Well, I think they're on the move because they are scared in their own countries. First off, there's direct violence. They have the highest homicide rates in the world outside of a war zone. They're scared because they're living under mostly authoritarian regimes where there's no sense of what's going to happen to me the next day or whether I could get any kind of justice. And then they want more for themselves. So they're ambitious for some economic opportunities.
You expect them all to apply for U.S. asylum at an official checkpoint?
No, I don't. I think that, first off, most of them probably won't make it to that far. I mean, this is really hard work, and at least historically, the fact that they're traveling together increases some of their chances of some of them making it there because they won't get picked off as they go. But this is really difficult. It's a difficult struggle. So I think the obvious choice here and the choice that my book really argues for is help people where they live to make the best choices they can and to follow their own instincts. And so the United States is a catalyst for giving people those opportunities. We're not a colonial power. We escaped colonialism. We know how awful it was.
And perpetrated it in places.
And when we do it, it's never very good. And we occupy places like Haiti for a decade or two. It doesn't work. And lots of people die. And it doesn't help the soul of America, from my view.
So what would you do with Honduras?
I actually had a chance to work in Honduras in my last job as the Assistant Secretary of State for Conflict and Stabilization Operations. And we just felt that the first thing that had to happen is that their political system needed to recognize that the homicides were the number one problem in their country. They had to get on top of that. And in every way, the first way was in recognizing that that was their number one problem. And of course, in the presidential campaign, two presidential campaigns ago in Honduras, they did recognize this as the number one issue, and every candidate addressed it, partially because we helped them to focus on this, but also it then shows up in things like if a homicide takes place, will any of the witnesses ever testify? Will the police actually take the testimony in a reliable way that doesn't result in the death of the witness? Will the courts actually move quickly enough? I mean, these are all very practical problems that, on the other hand, there were successes in Honduras. It wasn't like every policeman couldn't do an investigation and every prosecutor couldn't prosecute and every judge couldn't figure out a way. And there was a group right in downtown Tegucigalpa that was in the worst part of Tegucigalpa that was getting an 85% conviction rate. Now, if it's happening in one place in Honduras, could it happen anywhere else in Honduras? Well, of course it could. And so taking those experiences and trying to nationalize them and helping them to popularize them and recognizing that Hondurans could actually solve their own problems, those are all things the United States can help with, and they're inexpensive, and they don't require. For a while there in Honduras, we actually had a prosecutor from Seattle down there advising their prosecutors on how to build the cases on some of the high profile cases, and you know that was useful, but not anywhere near as useful as finding the local example that we could build off of.
Do we have the trust of the people of Honduras, where the U.S. has been intervening since banana companies, building railroads and banks 100 years ago, more than 100 years ago.
So our checkered past is clearly a problem for us. On the other hand, many of these people don't have great choices. So they may not be totally trusting of us, but 40% of them trust us, and 22% of them trust their own government. So, you know, it's oftentimes it's comparative.
This is former UN Ambassador Rick Barton. Can we talk about Yemen, where the United Nations says dozens of children are dying every day because you know about the civil war there, the medical services are collapsing, the U.S. is not a neutral actor. What should the United States do?
Well, I'm afraid that this is another one of these cases where we've overreached and our being a primary arms supplier to the Saudis leaves us with a very limited set of choices. We have tried diplomatically. Some of my friends have been ambassadors and served in Yemen for the United States and as UN negotiators as well. And I don't have a comfortable or clean or a simple answer to that one. And because I really haven't worked, even though I've worked in over 40 conflicts, fortunately, I've not worked in Yemen. But it does strike me as if the downward direction of the whole country and the growth in population and the very, very limited resources and natural opportunities helps to feed this witch's brew that's being stirred there now.
Well, Saudi Arabia has been an ally a long time. Here's a question: what would President Obama do any differently?
Yeah, I'm not sure that President Obama would. I don't know what he would have done. He did obviously try the diplomatic route at some length with very limited effect. But I think that one of the things that my book really brings out is that we oftentimes don't know the places very well. And I would put Yemen in that sort of small, curious place that very few Americans know. And I've got a really simple rule of thumb to keep us all honest, which is if you don't know at least 100 people in a place, don't send U.S. soldiers. And that would probably go for armaments as well.
I mean, if the president doesn't know 100 people or the general and the chief of staff of the Defense Department?
I would say if the United States doesn't, you know, if all we know is six ministers and three or four international diplomats and 10 business people, that's not a good base. And by the way, if we followed that rule, we probably wouldn't have been stuck in Afghanistan for 17 years. And we probably could have even avoided Vietnam, which we knew relatively well. But many of these places, we get to know our 100th person after we've been there for 6 or 8 months. That's a pretty dangerous. Well, how about if we spend the time up front?
Well, what about Iraq, where the United States, you know, we know 100 people in Iraq that we're not nearly as much of a stranger. And obviously it didn't go well.
We do now, but I'm not convinced that we did when we went into the place. In fact,
I remember hearing Baghdad called the Paris of Iraq.
Yeah, it might have been, but it didn't feel like any part of Paris that I've ever seen when I was there. It felt like something could go wrong any second. And I was there in a very good time when the U.S. had just completed its first military sweep. But I didn't have any feeling that we were grounded in the place because all we'd basically been doing is we'd been working in the Kurdish part of the country quite a bit before the war, and we had been enforcing a no-fly zone through big parts of the country. But our on-the-ground knowledge of Iraq was very, very limited, and it wasn't current. And even after the long war we fought there and evacuated, when the ISIS problems started to arise, I was visited by one of America's senior-most generals who had been responsible for the intelligence gathering during the first big phase of the war there. And I said to him, well, you must have hundreds of intelligence contacts still. And he looked at me like, no, we don't. And so, you know, this is where our humility is a long way from where it needs to be.
Your book includes the subtitle is about a unifying role in a turbulent world. Mm-hmm. Sure doesn't feel very unified here. What can we, how can this country unify anyone?
Well, we have a lot of work to do ourselves, and obviously our reverting to hate speech and to everything being us versus them. I mean, most of us don't know 10 people who have an opposing point of political view that we talk with on a regular basis, and certainly if we do talk with them, never about this. So that's not a very healthy grounding for our international work, but sometimes our international work can be a unifying source for us as well, because it does make us recognize some of these fundamental qualities that we may be lacking in introspection. Mm. You know, my great-grandfather was a Protestant minister, and he had a line that I just love because I think it's so true. He said, you know, the human stomach can digest anything except for introspection. And, you know, we all need to be a bit more thoughtful about the criticisms that we're leveling against other people and the surety we have. In Washington, there's many conversations start with, well, the fact of the matter is. It's like, I didn't hear any facts before or after that statement.
Mm-hmm. So I'm always asking for advice for a KUOW listener, for a Seattleite listening. Okay. It sounds like introspection is your... I think some humility.
You may already have that in Seattle. That's why some of us come this far.
This is former UN Ambassador Rick Barton, who teaches at Princeton at the Woodrow Wilson School there. And he has served as the Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees at the UN, First Assistant Secretary of State, Conflict Stabilization under President Obama. His new book is Peaceworks, America's Unifying Role in a Turbulent World. And Rick, you're speaking Wednesday at noon for a World Affairs Council event at the Westin in Seattle, right?
Yes, and it's also a Rotary event.
And a Rotary event. And you can find tickets to that talk at the World Affairs Council website under events. Ambassador Rick Barton, thank you for writing it. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Great, great, great interview.
It's The Record on KUOW. Coming right back. It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. I'm not finding a ton of good political Halloween costumes online. It's mostly Trump masks, of course, but that's too obvious. And after that, they get kind of obscure. You can dress like the 11-year-old boy who offered to mow the White House lawn, the red short-sleeve polo and khaki shorts and safety goggles and gloves and a lawnmower, of course, if you can afford that. Some people are trying to go as the P-tape. I see the supposed video of Trump in a Russian hotel room. It gets very, very creative. But here's a better way to get political this week. Tomorrow night, there's an event called Political Mischief, featuring a group of Seattle journalists, two of whom are with me right now. Sarah Ann Lloyd is editor at Curb Seattle. Erica C. Barnett writes about local politics at thecisforcrank.com. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
What are you going to be for Halloween? Are you Halloweeners?
I will be dressed as an adult.
Uh-huh.
Which means that I will be standing at my door waiting for the usually non-existent trick-or-treaters.
Uh-huh.
And I am armed with candy, which I will probably mostly eat myself.
Consume on your own, yeah.
I had a whole elaborate costume planned. I was going to be Dr. Girlfriend from the Venture Brothers. I was going to craft my own costume because Halloween is usually the one time I get crafty.
Yeah.
And then I realized it was the Saturday before Halloween, so I bought googly eyes to glue to my face and be a spider.
Is anything Halloween-y going to happen at Political Mischief?
Well, I think the concept, Paul Mullen, the guy who's organizing this whole event, was explaining to me that this is like an East Coast thing, and I'm not from the East Coast, where everybody goes around and like sounds like kind of horrible to each other, like, you know, egging each other's houses and TPing each other's houses and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
So this is based on, I think, that general idea. East Coast people are probably screaming at their radios right now because I'm getting it so wrong.
Because a Texan is mangling it?
Exactly.
Classic East Coast.
Okay, so Political Mischief, maybe smashing pumpkins that look like Ted Cruz. We don't know exactly what's going to happen. But you are going to be it's not just people talking. It's sort of there's a performance aspect to what's happening tomorrow night, right?
Right.
Erica, you're going to be sort of storytelling from your own brush with the Seattle Times and Next Door?
Well, so last time I did something like this, I read from Twitter. And so this time, sort of continuing with that theme, I'm going to be reading some excerpts from Next Door,
mm-hmm.
which is a social media site that I got into a bit of a scrap with a couple years ago because they were having events with the Seattle Police Department chief on their social media site, which should have been public and weren't made public. And so I was...
That's the problem. Next Door is kind of about... It's just us.
Just us.
In this particular neighborhood.
This is where you can say, you know, where you can put up a post about your missing cat or report a guy who happened to be wearing a hoodie and get 900 comments from your neighbors about it. And so
So you'll be reading. You'll be performatively.
I'm going to be reading some excerpts of things that people have said on Nextdoor. There's a Seattle Times article about this when I got kicked off Nextdoor because of this this public event that I publicized on Twitter. And yeah, and I'll just be talking about kind of the state of discourse around local issues in Seattle.
I know you know that some Nextdoor posters feel that in that you accuse them of demonizing and that they feel demonized by you. You know that. It's a demon. It's a good time for talk demons. It is a Halloween event.
Well, that's yeah, that's a really good point. So, you know, if you want to find out what I have to say about Nextdoor or if you feel demonized, I guess, come out to this event. It's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock.
Sarah, you're doing a poetry reading.
I am.
Please tell.
So if you're not familiar
with...
Is it
Sarah or Sarah Ann?
It's Sarah.
Sarah.
I use my middle name because there are many Sarah Lloyds.
It
was an early decision based on Google ability.
Yes.
Also, I guess it has a good rhythm to it, so
yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
So if you're not familiar with erasures, they're a type of poetry where you start with a source text and you don't add any words to it. You just take words away.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So, you know, people have done this for a long time with existing poetic works, with novels. Occasionally you'll find one that an artsy person left on a bus ripped from a thrift store book.
Yes.
Something like that.
Right.
So I'm going to be doing erasures based on editorial pieces and election relevant things and that kind of thing. So there's one piece that was a Seattle Times editorial that was a call for civility on both sides that I'm going to erase a little bit to make it more about how calls for civility are feel very silencing.
Appropriate for an erasure performance.
Right, exactly. There's one that was a piece about that I wrote some of these back in July when I was doing a different reading. One of them is about Amazon pausing their tower development during the head tax debacle, and it's turned more into something about feelings of insecurity living in a city with a rising cost of living, that kind of thing.
Here's the thing, though, Sarah. I like poetry because it's indirect, unlike politics.
Right.
Why mix the two?
I mean, part of it is because I do like it to be indirect, right? There's no one way to be political. There's no one way to have your identity affected by politics. And I think it gets to how politics get into our everyday lives and get into our psyche, and it does so in really indescribable ways. I think that there's a lot of very direct, pointed exploration about how these things make us feel on social media platforms, and I wanted to get more into a more wishy-washy place, I guess.
Erica C. Barnett, the local media are at home, and there's a bowl of candy next to their door, and you knock on their door, and they open it up, and
why does this sound like a setup for a trick question?
Yeah, it's like you're I'm imagining you trick or treating, and you want to tell, and this is your chance to tell. What do you want to tell local media when they open the door, and there's Erica C. Do you wish local media were more politically mischievous, or more civil?
It depends on what you're talking about when you say local media.
Uh-huh.
I do think, to Sarah's point, I do think our obsession with civility and our kind of the local media's sort of, oh my, you know, reaction to change in Seattle.
We have the vapors.
Yeah. I mean, it feels, and this is sort of what, you know, what I talk about in the piece that I'm going to be reading, you know, is it feels like people do get the vapors about change and frankly overreact to certain elements of change that they see in their neighborhoods. And social media in particular really exacerbates people's ability to do that in a bubble. And so I would say social media, particularly places like Nextdoor and Facebook groups and things like that, you know, are sort of the distillation of the worst instincts of people. And if we were talking to each other outside our social media bubbles on places like Nextdoor, you know, it probably wouldn't be the case that people would post about seeing a guy in a hoodie or, you know, or say, oh, my God, I saw, you know, a drunk person down at the QFC, which is one of the examples I'm going to be talking about. And, you know, and it turned into this like cavern of empathy where, you know, empathy goes to die and everybody is just horrified at the wrong things. So that's what I would say to people who are posting on social media.
So when you meet someone off of social media and if things aren't amped up in that way, can you empathize with, honor their well-meaning love for things the way they used to be?
I mean, as long as their attachment to the way things used to be isn't based on wanting to exclude people from their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
Or
do they have to go hand in hand? The nostalgists and why did they have to ruin Seattle? Can they not be? Is there any open hearted way to be nostalgic for Seattle as it was?
I think so. I mean, it depends on the project. That's why sometimes it's good to be indirect with this kind of thing.
Yes.
You know, one of the reasons why I decided to do the pieces I was doing is because we think of. Back to the idea of the media as some kind of big, single, goopy specter or something. As the media is a whole bunch of human beings, all with a whole bunch of opinions that are their own. And ostensibly, we're not supposed to have opinions, right?
Right.
But, you know, the way that we vet things and the way that we decide what is valid and reportable is all influenced by our experience and our own personal lens and that kind of thing. So, I mean, I really like being able to put humanity kind of back into it. And that, you know, that middle ground is something that is kind of lost and not acknowledging humanity. But at the same time, often when we say middle ground, it's lately in the political climate, it means interviewing someone who has bad ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think, you know, one thing that I have noticed really potently in the last few years of being on social media a lot and tweeting and kind of engaging with people on Twitter is that, and I don't have time to do this, I mean, nobody does, but like to the extent that I can actually just talk to people outside that sort of like, you know, punching at each other place on Twitter or on Facebook or whatever, it's always better. And people are always just, I mean, almost without exception, completely different. I mean, they're
yes,
dialed back so much from their social media personas. And I think, again, like places like Nextdoor, places like any social media tend to exacerbate that. And well, I love Twitter, but it has its problems.
Let's get together in person then. Political Mischief Night, hosted by Loudmouth Lit. That's tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, St. Andrews Bar and Grill with Sarah Ann Lloyd from Curbed Seattle. Erica C. Barnett from The C is for Crank. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And I wrote down this phrase, this year I'm going to go to Halloween as a big, single, goopy specter. That was good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's The Record coming back. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Washington's Supreme Court has been in the news a lot lately for decisions on charter schools, juvenile life without parole, and the death penalty. Getting less attention are the three justices up for re-election on the November ballot. Only one of those races is contested. But the incumbent justice worries that voters aren't paying attention. KUOW's Austin Jenkins explains.
Justice Stephen Gonzalez is still haunted by what happened in his 2012 race for the Washington Supreme Court. An appointee to the court, he had to run that year to keep his seat. Yet in the August primary, Gonzalez's opponent, Bruce Danielson, beat him in a majority of Washington counties despite raising no money and not actively campaigning. In Yakima County alone, Danielson got 64% of the vote. Now, Gonzalez still won the race because of support in vote-rich central Puget Sound. But in a post-election analysis, then University of Washington political science professor Matt Barreto and colleagues said the results strongly suggested that racially biased voting was at work in that election.
It was definitely the case that Justice Gonzalez paid a penalty in some parts of Washington for his surname.
This year, Gonzalez is running for re-election, and once again he faces an opponent who's raised no money and has no real campaign. But this time, his challenger, Nathan Choi, also has a non-white-sounding name. Barreto, who's now at UCLA, says both candidates may face some discrimination, especially in a nonpartisan race like a judgeship where there are no party labels.
We do see evidence of what the courts call racially polarized voting, meaning that the majority voters who are white are voting against candidates who they expect to be Black, Latino, or Asian American.
In this race, Barreto predicts some voters may choose not to vote for either Choi or Gonzalez.
They may choose to not vote in that election if they're looking for a representative that they believe will represent the white community better.
Gonzalez has been rated exceptionally well-qualified by several bar organizations and enjoys bipartisan support, but he worries voters don't know he's the incumbent. He points to a poll from last May from a liberal group that showed him trailing Choi, with most voters unaware of either of them.
My concern is that it's down ballot. There's no indication of who the incumbent is on the ballot itself. And so it takes a little bit more effort and work to learn about and to cast an informed vote on judges.
For his part, Choi, an attorney from Bellevue, has earned no ratings from bar associations. In 2017, he ran for the Washington Court of Appeals and was admonished by the King County Bar Association for violating the bar's guidelines on fair campaigns. The Washington Attorney General's office is currently seeking a default judgment against Choi in a campaign finance case also stemming from that race. The Yakima Herald newspaper, in a recent endorsement of Gonzalez, said Choi, quote, lacks any judicial experience and seemingly a modicum of ethical grounding. Choi declined an on-tape interview for this story and said to instead look at his website. It calls for an end to taxation and homelessness, frames the race for Supreme Court as a battle between slave masters and we the people, and includes links to YouTube videos like this one on the deep state.
The rule of law having been destroyed for decades by the deep state.
So far, Gonzalez has raised $300,000 towards his reelection, but he says that doesn't go very far in a statewide race. More broadly, he says he's concerned about the lack of attention given to judicial contests.
It's the responsibility of really all of us and greater community to focus on these races.
Two other Washington Supreme Court justices are also up for re-election this year, Susan Owens and Cheryl Gordon McLeod, but both of their opponents were bounced from the ballot because they were disbarred lawyers.
That's KUOW's Austin Jenkins. Thanks for tuning in today. The record's produced by Amina Al-Sadi, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Allison Bruzek, and Sophie Reed. And tomorrow, our guest is the King County Executive, Dow Constantine. Leave us a voicemail, 221-3663.